This fella Ronaldo is a cod.
Arsene Wenger's been in Japan for a year. He doesn't know anything about English football.
I will love it if we beat them.
This is Football Heritage.
Con Giovanni, incredible. Dribble, 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 dribble.
If you don't know the answer to that question, then I think you are an ostrich.
Right when we think we've seen everything the wild and wacky 2019-20 season has to offer, right at the very end, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang goes and drops the famous FA Cup trophy onto the Wembley grass. Hello and welcome to the Total Football Podcast. I'm your host, Egan Hart, and joining me is Andrew Conway.
Hello.
Andrew, why can't footballers be trusted with big metal cups?
Well, this was a week of destructive cup vandalism, because I think it was worse in Russia. I think it was the Zenit St. Petersburg and Ivanovic, formerly of Chelsea. I think they give out a crystal trophy and he managed to drop that and smash it.
Yeah, I saw that. That was funny.
Yeah, there was people holding up the arms of the trophy as if it was the trophy. Then like it was like a little ashes trophy. Yeah, so not great. Aubameyang clearly has never watched an FA Cup game before in his life, or an FA Cup final match before in his life, to not notice how to lift the trophy and thinking that the whole thing was part of the trophy, not the stand with all the names written on it. And nobody went to correct him on that. I think there was a couple, maybe Rob Holding was trying to point it out or something, but I don't think they were listening to him. I suppose this is the first year where it hasn't been presented to you. It's just kind of left there for you to take yourself. So that's kind of where it came from, the problems, I suppose.
Yeah, it was a really weird trophy presentation, obviously, just because of everything going on at the moment, that they kind of had to, like, they sanitized down the trophy. I saw a tweet, I think it was from Football Cliches on Twitter. It was like, those players are going to be wearing that thing as a hat in a few hours. So it was a bit absurd. But yeah, this really was kind of a direct consequence of COVID, that the trophy presentation was so weird, like, and it just led to a really humorous moment. Is like, I think it was David Luiz just did a huge way as a boy, like, dropped it, and then he picked it up and he had, like, he held the base of it, like, upside down as he held the trophy aloft, and it was all just so awkward. Like, it was really charming as well, just to see, like, players be, like, they just felt real, you know? They felt like real people in that moment, as opposed to...
They're really down to earth, you know? They're the real guy in the street. You can have a beer with that guy.
Yeah, it was just something spontaneous about it as well. Like, it was really funny just, like, seeing them pick up their medal as well, like, a little plate. And there's that one blondie-haired fella who no one has ever seen before or since. Like, I still don't know who he is.
Emile Smith Rowe. He's quite highly rated. He was on loan for most of the season. Yeah, that's Emile Smith Rowe. He got a medal. I'm pretty sure he played in the FA Cup at some point. He definitely was on the panel, so I think he deserved one. Aubameyang didn't get a medal. I don't know if anyone noticed that, because Socrates was giving out the medals by the time near the end of the, and they ran out of, basically, I think there was only about 20 medals left in the little box thing, and there was more than 20 Arsenal players there, so that it ran out fairly quickly.
Yeah, actually, fair play to Socrates. He was handing out about four or five of them, and then he turned around to pick one up for himself, and there wasn't one. So yeah, that was kind of funny.
Poor Socrates.
It's not as good or as funny, though, as what happened with Chelsea. There's just an offhand remark in the commentary of, like, yeah, the runners-up medals get picked up in a car park outside the stadium. I was like, that's such a depressing image.
Yeah, it was, because I saw, I think, the likes of Jorginho and stuff were just sitting around, and Mason Mount maybe as well, and they were like, are we allowed to go? And then there's some FA official eventually said, yeah, you're allowed to go. And then they just completely ran down the tunnel and were done with the whole event. And fair enough, it's tough enough to hang around afterwards when you've lost the cup final.
Yeah, it was actually kind of disappointing, because, like, when the crowd not being there, you miss out on, like, the few Chelsea fans, the few losing team fans crying in the stands. Like, we definitely missed that. All we got was the happy tears of Emiliano Martinez with his post-match interview with Aubameyang, which I suppose was nice enough.
Yeah, poor Emi Martinez crying, and, you know, he's had a weird season, I suppose. He probably never thought he would be basically Arsenal's number one now going into a new Premier League season. I don't know. It'll be very hard for Bernd Leno to replace him as a number one at this point, considering he's probably been one of Arsenal's best performers, along with Aubameyang and Saka, in a period where really Arsenal had very little positives out of the latter end of this season, where they would lose every second match for apparently no reason, despite them putting in great performances against bigger teams. He's definitely been one of the bright sparks of the post knockdown period for Arsenal, and it's been a whirlwind of a season for him. He's basically Arsenal's number one. He won an FA Cup. He played well in it. I don't think he had a huge amount to do throughout the final, but he did what he had to do for the most part. And now he's, you know, presumptive player going into a Community Shield match in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah, when you think of Arsenal season as a whole, I'm sure a lot of clubs have been doing their whole Player of the Year awards over the last week or so. But when you think about Arsenal's top four performers this season, you've probably got two goalkeepers in that slot, because Bert Leno was doing quite well up until his unfortunate injury against Brighton.
He did throw the ball in against Chelsea, if you remember, in one of Arteta's Arteta's first match as Arsenal boss. So with the exception of that, he did himself pretty well for the most of the season, and it was an unfortunate injury for him. But yeah, you're clutching at straws for great performers for Arsenal for the season. The majority of them have been kind of out of nowhere. Leno, as you said, Martinez out of completely, no one would have expected that. Martinelli earlier in the season, went before he got injured, was pretty good, and Saka. It's just Aubameyang who's kept the show on the road, really, and without his goals, you're looking at Arsenal being in a pretty precarious position in all the tournaments that they were in this season. Without Aubameyang's, what was it, 22 goals he got in the end? One short of Jamie Vardy's golden boot. I don't know where Arsenal would be in the league. They'd probably be pretty low down.
Yeah, it's not often you see the striker of the 8th place team almost win golden boot, but I suppose Danny Ings was, 11th or 12th, and he was up there as well. And 5th place as well actually won it.
Yeah, it's been a very strange season when you actually take account of it. It's only Liverpool in a way, and Man City kind of lost out because they lost their main goal scorer for crucial parts of the season in Aguero. That's probably why he didn't win golden boot. But yeah, Liverpool, it shows you how much they distributed the goals throughout the team, in that they didn't really have someone. Well, they, a couple of players were near enough. I think Salah was near enough getting the golden boot as well. He was a few goals off as well. But yeah, it's a kind of testament to that, and a sign of where the game is going in terms of where goals are coming from. They're coming from the flanks. They're coming from midfield. They're not necessarily coming from a designated scorer at the front of the pack. And it's only really the Danny Ings, Jamie Vardy, and Aubameyang that are kind of bucking that trend at this point.
But it was Aubameyang's two goals that set Arsenal on their way as they won 2-1 in that FA Cup final. Their 14th win in the competition. But just how important was this for Mikel Arteta and the club?
Well, apparently, for club-wise, first of all, and I think Arteta tackled that right after. I think that was the first question he was asked after the cup final. It was how important is it for the club? And he was like, oh, it's great, it's great. It's, given the very politically correct answer. But I think it was David Ornstein of the Athletic Forum with the BBC who kind of has the inside track on London football and definitely at Arsenal. And he said that even with the FA Cup victory and guaranteed Europa League football, their budget for the summer was going to be 30 million. And I'm not sure if that was after sales or before sales. So and this is a team that Arteta himself has called out as not having the requisite quality of player in the side. He said that after the Liverpool match when he said they have the heart, but they don't have the quality. We need better quality players in there. So yeah, I think it's vitally important that they got that. So at least they have some kind of starting point for Arteta to work from for next season. I don't see him building a team that could really challenge from the Premier League next season, but I do see him looking to get into that Leicester City mold of challenging for Champions League football.
Yeah, it does seem like it was a really important win. Obviously, a trophy is quite good for Arteta himself and his CV, but for the club itself, the 30 million that they get, 30 to 40 million that they get just from participating in the Europa League, it does seem like it's actually become quite massive given the various financial concerns across the league now, I guess, due to the coronavirus pandemic. But for Arsenal,
there's one thing I want to say on that is you have to remember, and this is often forgotten, it hasn't really been spoken about since everyone returned from post-lockdown to playing football again. Arsenal are the only Premier League team that docked their players' salaries. They took a 25% pay cut. Nobody else in Premier League, Norwich didn't do it. They got relegated. Bournemouth got relegated, didn't do it. Who else got relegated? I've completely blanked them from my mind. Watford didn't do it. Arsenal you know, supposedly a big club, docked their staff 25%. That is the reason Mesut Ozil was in Turkey this weekend and not playing the FA Cup final, because he refused to take the pay cut. You know, this, it's allegedly. So this is, it's very important for Arsenal to actually get this trophy and, as you say, get that money that they desperately need, because if they can't afford to pay the salaries of their players, I know there's been talk that Arsenal run a budget equivalent to a Champions League team on a Europa League budget, is what the, I think Josh Kroenke, who's the son of the owner, has said in recent years. It's still not good that you have to be the only club in the whole of the Premier League to dock your player salaries. Like, it is a bit of a bizarre situation that you need money that badly, and maybe this was more important than we could ever know for that club to keep going.
Yeah, like, it does very much seem like going into the transfer window now, like, Arsenal had two completely different strategies set up, whether they were in the Europa League or whether they weren't, and that secondary plan of them not being in Europe seemed like a pretty desperate one, one that would maybe set Arsenal back 2-3 years and really give Arteta a lot of work to do. But, like, now, as you say, they have that bit of wiggle room. Like, you imagine they'll sell one or two players as well in the window, which might help as well, but now it does look like they have just that, and just enough wiggle room that even if they don't sell anyone, they can still bring in one or two. And my concern at the moment is just the fact that now they have money to spend, will they spend it wisely? And the first report out is that they're going to spend a lot of money on bringing Willian on a 3-year deal to the club, which doesn't seem like a good use of resources at all.
No, it doesn't, to be honest. And, you know, whatever about Willian, I think he's a good player. I think he's a worker. He has always shown that at Chelsea. He is, even when he fell out with managers, which I think has happened on 3 occasions now, he still gets his head down and works a lot. And if you remember both the Jose Mourinho and the Conte season, he was one of the few performers that actually kept going, even if he didn't agree with the manager's methods. He kept scoring goals. He scored free kicks, I remember, in the Jose Mourinho era to kind of keep Chelsea afloat and out of the relegation zone in that kind of downward spiral they were in. But he is, what, 29, 30 at this point now. He's grown accustomed to a way of life at Chelsea, a kind of a coming on as a substitute, not necessarily being a starter every week. He didn't play the FA Cup final. He turned down a contract extension at Chelsea, multiple ones of them, so he could get this payday, is what is being presumed. His agent is Kia Drapcho, I can't pronounce his name, but, you know, Kia used to have Mascherano and Tevez and caused the whole Sheffield United fracas back in 2006 or whenever it was at this point, or 2007, I don't even remember. Yeah, 2007 with Mascherano and Tevez. So, and Sheffield United getting relegated and stuff like that, that came into it. He was part owner of those players at that point, along with West Ham, which is against the rules. But he is Edu's advisor / agent. He is in deep at the Arsenal Stadium now at the Emirates. And it's a bit worrying, being Willian's, as well as Cedric, as well as a few other players that have been brought in on kind of weird circumstances. It's a bit strange, if you ask me, that it's happening at all. Like, Willian, I apparently did turn down a 6-figure salary for a 3-year contract at Chelsea, so you'd imagine he'd at least be getting that. And this is an era where Arsenal are, as we said a few minutes ago, they're reducing the salaries of their players. They're cutting costs throughout the entire upwards and downwards of the club. And they're going to offer this guy a 6-figure salary, like 100, 200 grand maybe, for 3 years. And he's going to be in his 30s at that stage. Is he going to be contributing that much to it? Are they opening themselves up to a whole other Ozil, Alexis Sanchez situation where you just have dead weight effectively on a huge amount of money? Like, all of that being said, he is a good player. He's proven in the Premier League. He's proven at Champions League level. He's a Brazil international. I don't think there's any big question marks over his quality and taking a big risk on him. It's just the outlay and the kind of timeline involved is a bit of a worry, along with the people that are involved in it as well.
And then just for Spurs as well, the ramifications of Arsenal's victory means that they will have to go through 3 Europa League qualifying rounds. I'm sure a lot of Arsenal fans will enjoy the fact that they've managed to screw over Tottenham in victory as a little cherry on top, I suppose. But this will affect their ability to buy players as well, because, you know, they don't know if they're in the Europa League yet or not. Like, you imagine that they will qualify, because just generally the standard of teams that go into the Europa League qualifying rounds isn't all that great. So, you know, they can probably assume they'll get there, but they can't quite, because, like, if they want to spend 20, 30 million on a player, they might not have that if they're also relying on the Europa League money. Like, you have to remember, Tottenham were the only club to avail of the government's lending scheme that they announced there back in the middle of lockdown. So, like, they they also have their own financial concerns, especially due to the stadium that they, the new stadium that they're in, and the fact that a lot of the resources that they were going to use to bring in added revenue were to do with using the stadium, you know, offering NFL matches, offering concerts, all these sorts of things. They don't really have that at their disposal now. So that's added income streams gone as well that they have to think about.
You also have to think about what's happening with some of their players. You know, there was Ndombele their record signing, or was that usurped at some point? Because they're looking to offload him at a reduced rate, so they're going to lose money on him after one season. Mourinho isn't one for investing in youth. Apparently he's already started offloading all the young players off to loan deals the way he did at Chelsea and Manchester United. And you're looking at a tight squad that is already quite aged. Like, I'd be a bit worried about Spurs going into next season no matter what, because Mourinho's in charge, because he's going to find scapegoats, he's going to underperform, they're not going to do very well, they're going to finish a miserable, not finish miserable, but they're going to be running like in lower top half of the table. They're going to be in between 5th and 8th, I think, for the majority of next season if he stays. And it's not going to be very encouraging football. So, you know, on top of everything else, it's going to be a pretty miserable time for Spurs fans next season, I predict.
And I think that it doesn't bode well, the fact that the first player they've been linked with signing is Troy Deeney from Watford, which would just be a bizarre signing, really.
Yeah, but he's kind of Mourinho's type of player. He's got character. He's got cojones, as Mourinho would like to point out. I don't think he's the goal scorer they necessarily need at Tottenham, but they do need someone to give a bit of respite to Harry Kane from playing 90 minutes every week, because it is really wearing on him. You can tell when he's playing that much football, even without his injuries, it would be wearing on any player. And, you know, the games are going to come even thicker and faster next season, because you're going to have to throw in, as we said, cup competitions like the Europa League, and international football is going to return as well, and Harry Kane will be expected to play all of that. So Mourinho, he will have his excuses, I'm sure. But he is going to actually have to come up with solutions to these problems, not just complain about them. And Deeney might be the way into that.
And then just in terms of the actual FA Cup final itself, you know, there were Chelsea as well who lost the match. They started well, you know, they took the lead, and it seemed like, you know, they might get a pretty dominant win over Arsenal, because they had a couple chances before the goal itself, even if it was early, and it was a nice, well-taken goal. But then, you know, from there, Arsenal seemed to settle after that, and then they pegged them back with a penalty. A penalty that you could see coming as well. Like, Arsenal very clearly and very quickly figured out what was going wrong with Chelsea's system and exploited the gap there that Azpilicueta's just lack of space in behind had left. And that's what led to the goal. That's what led to his injury, the first of many injuries for Chelsea in this match. And it was quite strange how that... first of all, the injury to Azpilicueta almost helped Chelsea, just because how slow he was and how he was just getting done every time with the ball over the top. So they brought on Christensen, who was just that bit more solid. But it was crazy how, like, Lampard just wouldn't adapt. He wouldn't change his style. And really, ultimately, it never really seemed like they were playing a high line because of some intense tactical plan that he had ready for the game. It felt like he just kind of played a high line because...
Yeah, like, early on, and it was very annoying for me, I was watching on BT commentary and they were just loving it. Was Glenn Hoddle mostly and Fletch, as they say, Darren Fletcher, the lead commentator on BT Sport, were just going on about how, Lampard's out-tacticked Mikel Arteta here in the first few minutes. And they were talking as if Chelsea had been playing this football for 80 minutes and it had only been about 10 minutes gone, and then I think Chelsea scored in that time. Like, fair enough, Lampard set out with an interesting system, a weird hybrid five at the back and then three forwards, but having them all play with inside like 5 meters of each other, having no presence on the wings whatsoever. And it was great for the first few minutes because it basically overloaded Arsenal's centre half. They had three centre backs and suddenly they had three players they had to deal with. So if one committed themselves, there would be basically another player who could move forward from midfield in the form of Mason Mount generally, and you'd be creating problems all over Arsenal's back three to back five. But what Lampard didn't really contend with was the fact that you do that, you have no pressure on the wingbacks whatsoever. And you saw very quickly how both Bellerin, who had a pretty good game and probably one of his best games since coming back from injury, and his long shallowing run led to the second goal. And on the left-hand side, strangely enough, Ainsley Maitland-Niles, who very likely could be leaving Arsenal, that could be his last game for the club. just had acres of space to run into. There was no one putting pressure on them. There's no one he had to mark because there was no wingers or no offensive players playing up those wings. And they got to just run at Chelsea the whole, you know, the whole period subsequent to Arsenal going 1-0 down. And yeah, and you're completely right. Frank Lampard did not react to it at all. It was only when injuries started accumulating did he actually start changing anything in the team. And then when he did, he didn't really do much to change the style or the shape of the play. Like when, like Christensen did help the situation, but when Pulisic got injured, which was I think a pretty big loss because he was probably the only creative spark in that Chelsea side in the first half, really. He replaced him with Pedro, which is, you know, more of a like for like replacement. But if your rest of your team isn't really working in the system, why would you put the same player working in the same system? And that's kind of what he did, instead of really changing it up and put Tammy Abraham in there, who had pace. And there was one thing that this Arsenal defence lacked, it was pace. And I would have brought on Abraham much sooner, and would have even, you know, he did eventually in sacrificing Giroud to do that. But yeah, it was strange from Lampard that he didn't really show any acumen, really understanding of game management, and he kind of got outdone by it very early on in the match. Like, you saw how he recoiled as the match went on more and more. At the beginning of the game, if you watch, they're kind of the two managers, you know, Arteta's very much on the touchline the whole time talking to the players the whole match, and Lampard started doing that as well at the beginning of the match. But then as the first half went on, Lampard retreated more and more back into talking to Jody Morris, isn't it, Jody Morris's assistant, and the other assistants there for Chelsea, and kind of, you know, not being in touch with his players, not communicating with them and keeping them motivated and keeping them tactically sharp, while Arteta was there adjusting things constantly. And you can tell that's kind of the difference between the two managers, I think.
And then in 2016, FA Cup final day saw the sacking of Louis van Gaal, but this year it also saw the departure of Eddie Howe from Bournemouth. A pretty big moment for both the club and the man himself.
I don't know what Bournemouth are going to do now, because we presumed that they might have a season with Eddie Howe at the helm, or at least part of a season with Eddie Howe at the helm in the Championship. Without him, what are they going to do? Are they going to parachute in a big name? Are they going to go to Germany and hire the way that the likes of like Brentford have, and the way that Southampton have, and, you know, other near companions to Bournemouth down in the south coast? What are they going to do? I don't see a strategy at play here. For him, it's probably a good move. He's had a tumultuous season, to say the least. He's been relegated, which isn't the best way to end a tenure with any club. But, you know, I think you told me almost immediately that West Ham would be waiting, and maybe they are. And maybe they won't sack David Moyes immediately and do the same thing they did a couple of years ago. But I think Eddie Howe will be waiting in the wings as soon as David Moyes starts slipping up early next season.
Yeah, like, it's interesting because, like, obviously, I think, you know, West Ham could be a very viable place for him to go. I think Crystal Palace also could be a pretty interesting place for him to go. You know, Roy the Boy getting on in his early 70s there, and Crystal Palace have a very ageing squad themselves. So maybe if he can get a bit of a rebuild project going there, that would be an interesting project for him. But at the same time, this is a guy who's, you know, quite young in terms of, you know, especially compared to Roy Hodgson. He's still in his 40s, I think, so... In that sense, it feels like he's not been around a long time, but he's been manager since around 2008, I believe. So, like, he has been around for quite a long time, pretty relentlessly working as well. Like, I don't think he's had any breaks, because he did leave Bournemouth for, was it Burnley at one point? I can't quite
Burnley,
remember.
Yeah, he got homesick. It didn't really go very well. Yeah, and he left the club, basically. It was a strange situation.
And then he went back to Bournemouth, obviously, and from there he's been immensely successful, and back-to-back promotions, 5 years in the Premier League. Like, that's a huge success for Bournemouth. They've been a great story those last few years, and he built quite the side there. Like, they were quite formidable. Like, they weren't, like, scrapping around the relegation places over those 5 years. Like, this is kind of the first time they got dragged into it, and I suppose the relegation vortex got them at the first time of asking. Maybe this is a chance for Eddie Howe to just kind of take a break, relax. You know, he's built up a good reputation. You know, like, don't rush into the first job that comes, because, you know, we've seen managers do that in the past and it not go well for them, and it just kind of buries their reputation even further, because, you know, I suppose a relegation isn't the best thing for Eddie Howe's CV. Which I suppose is why I'm surprised that he's gone. Like, I thought, you know, maybe a year at Bournemouth, maybe try to bring them back up, or at least as a year of transition, you know, because I imagine like Nathan Ake is gone this week. I imagine more will follow. So yeah, for those players to all leave and the managers to leave, like, it really does feel like there's a huge rebuilding job at hand at Bournemouth.
Yeah, it makes you think that maybe there is a plan behind the scenes, that I think they're Russian owners behind Bournemouth, and maybe they have a plan or an idea in place of what they want to bring in. They are going to lose a lot of players. Ake is already gone, and it's a bit of money, so that's a bit of saving grace for them. And they've made profit on that as well, a significant profit on the sale of Ake. But you can imagine that they did have good contracts with a lot of players in terms of if they got relegated, they would get a reduction in salary. So there is a possibility of holding on to some of those players if they don't get another club, which, you know, given the coronavirus and a lot of the implications that's had on finances of clubs in and around the top of the Championship, lower half the Premier League, a lot of players probably won't have an option to get another Premier League club unless they're very good. I'm thinking maybe Fraser might get another club, maybe a couple of their four players. But, you know, Solanke is not going anywhere. Is Jordan Ibe still even there? He's probably not going anywhere either if he is. And they might get a redo of some of the loan signings they had from last season that kind of made them look good earlier on in the season before they kind of drifted away from November onwards. But yeah, it is a weird one, and until it becomes a bit clearer, it will look like a mistake on Bournemouth's side to get rid of Howe at this point, unless it was him that instigated the whole, you know, departure.
And then finally in the news, the proposed takeover deal of the sale of Newcastle United collapsed this week. The Saudi-backed investment fund pulled out of the deal and amid controversies over their human rights records and their BLQ piracy network.
Yeah, it seems to be that was the main bugbear in the end, was the whole piracy of the Premier League rights in the Middle East. And for now, the Premier League has sided with their business arrangements, whether that will change in the future and Newcastle will get purchased at that point by this Saudi group or another rival Saudi group will yet to be seen. But for the moment, it doesn't look like they're going to be purchased, and Steve Bruce is going to be there for another year at least, and Mike Ashley will be there as well. Disappointing from a Newcastle point of view, maybe not from the likes of what's the name of that charity that does the Amnesty International. They are quite pleased with the result that they didn't get bought by the Saudi group, and they won't have another opportunity for sports washing in the West. I can see it from both angles. Obviously, Newcastle just want to get the back of Mike Ashley at this point. And not having him at the club, I think, would be a bonus for them. But I think getting rid of him at any cost mightn't have been the correct tactic in this market. And it might come back to come back and save them later on down the line. There could be a better purchaser coming. That's their only hope at this point.
I ultimately do think this is a good thing for both Newcastle and for football. Like, I know Newcastle fans online have kind of gone mad. Like, the Newcastle Supporters Trust, which is the official kind of fan group of Newcastle United, have condemned the Premier League for this, even though it wasn't their decision ultimately. I suppose in that sense it was actually a big win for the Premier League that it wasn't their decision, that the Saudis just pulled out of it, because I think no matter what decision they would have taken, they weren't going to be pleased with the outcome of it, because in one way they would have pissed off the likes of Amnesty International, they would have kind of sold their soul a little bit more. And if they had gotten rid of them, then I suppose they would have felt the wrath of the Saudis themselves. So that was a Sophie's choice for them that's just been kind of removed from their hands. So in that sense, they're probably delighted that the only people mad at them are Newcastle fans. But like, ultimately, I think you make a good point. Like, you know, the grass could be greener, I suppose, without them. You know, that someone else might come in. There has been rumours that someone else is already looking, and some American businessman is looking at a purchase. Vince McMahon's name always gets thrown around, which I think would be amazing.
It would be great.
I did see him linked to Sunderland as well this week, so weird.
That would be even better. Did you, yeah. as a very quick aside, did you see the financial results that came in this past week from the second season of Sunderland Till I Die from the Sunderland club, and how they had a wage bill that was twice as large as the next club, and that most of the wage bills would have been afforded by Sunderland in League One? Like, it was mad, the money that's involved with that club still. And it's not looking any better for them as they are about to return to another season in League One.
Yeah, like that is the thing. Like, Newcastle fans are obviously very unhappy with Mike Ashley as an owner, and I'm not going to sit here and defend Mike Ashley in any way. I'm sure he's been terrible, and you know, Newcastle fans have good reason to dislike him. But when you compare to what's going on at Sunderland, Newcastle kind of have it a bit cushy. You know, they're
it could be worse.
Happy in 13th. Yeah, so, you know, all in all, things could be a lot worse for Newcastle.
It's the history of the Tottenham. We believe in the history.
The long-awaited return of the Champions League is upon us. On Friday night, the ball gets rolling again as the remaining last 16 second-leg ties are to be played. The full draw for the final three rounds of the competition was made weeks ago in UEFA's Neon headquarters, so we can now map out the potential routes to the final. With 12 teams left, how will they will themselves down to two, and which team will come out on top as Europe's best?
Zidane's Real Madrid, most likely, because it's Zidane and he always wins the Champions League whenever he's competed in it.
Despite a 2-1 deficit going into the second leg in the Etihad this week.
It doesn't matter, because every time I've backed against Zidane in the knockout phases of the Champions League, which has been basically every single tie, he has won it. And I have no legs to stand on. So they won the league in Spain. They've had a few weeks to kind of process that and to work on this one match against City where they just have to overturn, like they just have to score twice and they're through. Benzema has talked about how he wants to become an MMA fighter, which is, you know, I'm sure John Stones is delighted to hear that. So yeah, you can't really the back against Real Madrid at this point. I also just want to make a shout out to UEFA's Neon headquarters, because it makes it sound like it's a futuristic neon lit building, which it really isn't. It's just a boring building in Switzerland or somewhere.
See, when I think of the word neon, I just think of like Formula One cars where I'm like, meow.
Yeah.
Neon headquarters.
Yeah, it works both ways, really.
Maybe the Formula One headquarters should move back to Neon for that one really niche joke.
It would.
That doesn't
be
even
great.
Really work anymore.
No, it'd be great.
So yeah, I do worry though, just for the for your own jinxing's sake, that now that you finally backed Real Madrid, they might lose.
Yeah, well they are trailing, you know, so they are losing the tie, and they were fairly outplayed in that first leg, and they don't have Sergio Ramos playing. I think he is suspended, isn't he, for this?
Yeah.
It's been so long since the first leg, it's funny that it's even happened. I honestly think they should just toss a coin for the result and we just go on to the quarterfinals. I'd be happy with that.
That'd be a real throwback to the original glory days of the European Cup, and that's how they settle the ties. This is an interesting matchup, just because like you make a point, like it was so long ago, like it feels like a completely different world, and in many ways it is a completely different world since that day in mid-February, early February, is that when the first leg was?
Something like that,
is really weird that like half the draw is made because some of the last 16 ties did get finished, but the other half didn't. So we're left with 12 teams in an 8-team tournament. And as well, the fact that the quarterfinals, when they do go ahead, will be one-legged as well. Like, there's so many weird ramifications of the rest of this competition, let alone the fact that two of the French teams haven't played properly in months besides one cup final there last week. And the fact that like some of these leagues have been finished, like the Bundesliga has been finished for about 6 weeks. The Premier League just finished last week. The Serie A league only finished this week, so a lot of weird variables going into the last few games here.
Yeah, like who's going to be even up for it? It's going to be a very strange tournament. We've seen already in all the returns to football, where there has been returns to football, how kind of diluted and lacking in intensity the matches have been. And will that continue into the Champions League, or will it, you know, spark up a bit more ferocity in these players? Will hearing the Champions League anthem at the beginning really get these players going? I wouldn't hold out hope for it, but it could be very interesting, because we'll see a very different style of football. We'll see probably something a lot more based on skill and technique than we've seen in recent years, because I don't know about you, but it's been fairly rough and tumble the last couple of years in the Champions League. It's been very the teams just who run after it more, who get more behind the ball, who psychologically psych out their opposition to tend to get ahead in a lot of the ties. But I can't see that happening in this, because it'll be so sedate. There'll be no noise. Everyone will be pally beforehand, probably. There'll be no, you know, I can't imagine there being massive tackles going in. It's going to be very, very quiet football and very unusual. So it would be, I think it's a tournament for the likes of Kevin De Bruyne to come alive if he does for Man City. The likes of like Lionel Messi, Leo Messi could do something very amazing in this tournament, because you know, it'll be up to a player like him to kind of do something, because I don't see the guys that run hard and really get after other opposition players, the likes of Sergio Ramos, if he does get another chance in this tournament, won't really have much of an opportunity to really get under people's skin.
Yeah, like it is going to be weird, like, as well, the fact that, like, even just look at the likes of RB Leipzig don't have Timo Werner at the club, because he's been sold. He's at Chelsea. He's going to be, you know, probably in the stands watching his Chelsea play Bayern Munich in a couple of weeks in that complete dead rubber of a tie, which in itself is quite strange that they're making Bayern Munich play Chelsea despite having a 3-0 away goal lead. It'd be very difficult to see that get overturned. But considering the teams left in the competition, considering the fact that, you know, we have the draw all the way up to the final, which is incredibly unusual. Like, everything about this is incredibly unusual. Like, it's all in Lisbon, basically. It's only one-legged affairs. There's no away goal rules. Like, over the last few years, the Champions League has been, you know, heralded by the fact that it's got the away goals rule. It's got two legs. So we've seen absolutely incredible comebacks. Like, we've got the 6-1. Basically, PSG have been at the root of all of them. But, like, there's been the ones between Real Madrid and Bayern Munich, Real Madrid and Juventus as well. Those incredible ties. So
Liverpool, Barcelona. There's Roma against Barcelona and Roma against Liverpool were both fantastic matches. The Man City Liverpool matches were great. Tottenham against Man City last season. The Tottenham against Ajax match is probably one of the games of the decade, of the last decade, because it was so crazy. And all of that will be gone now. And I don't see anything like that really replacing it, to be honest. We're probably going to have situations where teams are going to pull ahead and that'll be the end of the tie after 20, 25 minutes.
Yeah, like, I think it could end up kind of looking a lot like what the Euros was supposed to look like this year. Like, this very much is the replacement of that while we wait for it to come around next year. And, like, international football, like, it is a very low standard, generally speaking, just because we associate it with having, you know, lesser managers. Like, it's where managers kind of go to retire, or kind of young managers kind of come out of nowhere and give it a shot. Like, even Chris Coleman, I know, who's had a very long career, but a career that kind of stagnated for a while, and he's still quite young himself. Yes, he's not still Sunderland manager, is he?
No, he wasn't season one, though.
Yeah, you know, it's where we see a lot of substandard football, because those managers who are second rate don't really get a lot of time with their squads to implement a game plan, to kind of work with them over various tactical ideas, and even just to kind of improve them as individuals as well. You know, it's where we see the Champions League is where we see club football at its peak, at its absolute pinnacle. And now that it'll be one-legged affairs, it'll be very edgy, very, very tight. Will we see a kind of regress into what we'd associate with international football? Like, will we see more penalty shootouts? They're very rare in the Champions League. So I suppose in that sense, that'll be fun. Penalty shootouts are always fun.
It could very well be every single tie. Except from the quarters on, anyway, it could be resulting in a penalty shootout. It will be cagey. It will be defensive. No one's wanting to lose those matches in the first 20 minutes, because if you go two goals down in 20 minutes, you're not coming back.
Yeah, like, you'd imagine, like, the spirit that's emboldened a lot of clubs in recent years to go for those comebacks won't really be there when, you know, you've just conceded the two goals. Like, that psychological blow, having just had something go against you, is going to have a knock-on effect. Whereas, I suppose, if you lose the first leg 2 or 3-0, you have 2 or 3 weeks to kind of forget about it and come back and get raring to go. And I suppose the precedent of the Barcelona 6-1 kind of started a knock-on effect of everyone else believing, no, comebacks are something that can be done in the Champions League. I suppose unless we see one in the first quarterfinal, that's absolutely incredible. We might not see any for the whole competition, and it might just set the benchmark.
Yeah, you're really hit the nail on the head there, and I think it will be fascinating viewing, no matter, you know, what level of football comes out of it or what kind of level of match comes out of it. I think it'll be one for the ages, because we're not going to see a repeat of this. So it's something you can say, oh, I saw that weird season where everything was played in one leg and weird stuff happened. That's probably the best thing that come out of this thing.
And I suppose to the Champions League's credit, like, it is incredible that they've been able to get this far. Like, the fact that we even think these matches will go ahead, like, we assume they will. Nothing catastrophic will happen in the next week or so. Like, it is impressive, and I suppose it's
nine misfortunes. I can't predict nine misfortunes.
I suppose we haven't really given enough credit to the leagues that have been able to go ahead. That they, you know, it is a miracle in that sense, because everything around it has been such a mess. And we've seen in America the sports leagues there have struggled to get back quite a lot.
It's only the NBA back so far, yeah.
Yeah, I think the Women's Super League is back as well. Okay. But I'm not sure. I don't really keep up with American sports that much myself. But the actual draw itself is throwing up some interesting ones. I suppose one half of the draw is a bunch of rookies, bunch of no winners, and on one side you've got basically every winner ever. Yeah. So it is quite an interesting split.
Yeah, like poor AC Milan not getting in the every winner ever group. Because they're terrible. But I'm very interested by Atalanta, whether they can, you know, just really rub the salt in the wounds of the likes of PSG and get something out of this tournament, because they've managed, and correct me if I'm wrong here, they've managed to roughly keep their squad together so far, haven't they? There's been no major transfers out of Atalanta yet.
Yeah, the only issue is one of their strikers, Josip Iličić, has gone home to Slovenia. I always get it mixed up. Due to personal reasons, not because of any transfer or anything. Apparently something's gone wrong in his personal life and he's gone back home. So obviously we wish him the best there. And that is an issue for Atalanta. You know, they're in a very attacking side. He scored plenty of goals in this season. Fortunately, they do have the likes of Luis Muriel, who has stepped up this season as well with a lot of goals, a lot of important goals. And they're not a team that has lacked goals this season. They scored, I think, the most goals of any of the teams left in the competition this season. So hopefully that won't affect them too much. And that Paris Saint-Germain game is the one I'm most looking forward to, just because, you know, it is the Goliath of Paris Saint-Germain and all the money in the world that they have against little Atalanta, who've built this incredible side, who've been so exciting this year, whose journey even to the quarterfinal has been emotional. It has had everything. It has had an incredible comeback. It's had a lot of goals, obviously. Like, it's had everything. And I suppose there's the emotion of Bergamo riding on this as well, because the second leg match against Valencia was seen as a biological bomb, I heard it described as. You know, it's been the potential cause of numerous illnesses and potentially even numerous deaths as well, just to the fans traveling to and from the games in Valencia in the previous round.
One of them was played. There's a lot riding on it. One of them was played behind closed doors, wasn't it?
But I don't think either of those games were. I think that was I one. Thought I think the they second were one of leg the few was. Games that went ahead.
They went ahead, but it was played behind. I think the one in Valencia was played, but people still travelled back and forth. And Atalanta, the region there suffered terribly due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and yeah, a lot of people did die, and maybe that it did have a bit of an influence on it. So it's something that I think it's an extra motivator for these Atalanta players and for the club itself to really pull something out against PSG, especially. Because it is like a show of, you know, the collective will against the might of a superpower, if you will, in global football terms, in the money-backed Paris Saint-Germain. And Paris Saint-Germain do have problems. Like, they are without Kylian Mbappe, probably their best player. Like, and they haven't played much football. As you said, they played one match in the last 3-4 months, and it wasn't much of a title, wasn't much of a contest in the end. So really, that's going for them. Unfortunately, I think the one-legged affair will probably suit PSG better. And I can see them doing Atalanta with a couple of early goals, because they still do have that overwhelming power in their attack, even without Mbappe. Like, you saw at Liverpool against them last season, it kind of happened as well. And even, you know, they have the propensity to be terrible, but, you know, they still managed to pull through and get results and get this far in the tournament. Unfortunately, I can see PSG winning this match.
And the winner of that match will play against the winner of RB Leipzig versus Atletico Madrid, which I think is a great chance for Atletico to get to another final. You know, they had the two in 2014 and 2016 that they lost to their local rivals Real Madrid in pretty heartbreaking fashion both times. So this is a good chance for them to kind of, you know,
lose
put
again
that
in
bed.
A final to Real Madrid against Zidane. Yes.
God, that would be so depressing for them.
Yeah, I think Simeone would just retire from football at that point. It's done.
So would all the players. Would just be like, oh, I've had enough of this.
Yeah, it would be like a Portugal Euro 2000 type of situation.
The loss of Timo Werner, I think, is a pretty big one for Leipzig. Like, he's got 30 plus goals this season for them. Like, he's been a huge talisman for them, source of a lot of their best performances as well. And I think that probably gives Atletico the edge in this match.
Yeah, like I was thinking over this match a bit more, and the thing that sticks with me is Atletico have been poor for most of this season. They haven't been great. They haven't pulled out their best performances. A lot of their players haven't been fantastic. Like there is some obviously bright sparks. The young Portuguese fellow, what's his name? He costs a load of money.
João Félix.
João Félix is a very good player, but you know, Costa is on his last legs. Thomas Partey hasn't been good. There's a bunch of like a bit mid-ranking players in the Atletico team this year. It was definitely a transitional season for them. And whether there's enough grit and determination to get through it, because I don't see them overwhelming with attacking flair and beating RB Leipzig that way, because Leipzig is a strongly and well-drilled team that even without Timo Werner, they will be difficult to beat. So I'd say this might be a bit of a dull affair, but you know, I'd hold out hopes, as opposed to the PSG at the Atlanta match, I'd hold out hopes in this match that there'll be an upset and you could see Leipzig into a semi-final.
And then on the other side of the draw, obviously there's the second legs to finish. You know, we expect Bayern Munich to go through, but there's also the Napoli-Barcelona game. Lyon have a 1-0 lead against Juventus, and you know, we've talked about Real Madrid, Manchester City. So there's some interesting matchups there. Who do you think will get through those?
Well, like Lyon still have an opportunity. Like they've had a few months. I don't know. Is whatchamacallit back yet? The your man, the Dutch fella, used to play for Manchester United. Again,
Memphis Depay.
I don't know if he's back from his injury yet. I haven't actually checked, and I probably should. But, you know, Lyon have had a few months to kind of recover from a few of their injuries. They've held on to most of their players, which is an important thing given the weirdness of this season. Juventus have played a lot more football, but they could be a lot more tired for that. They've already lost the cup final. They do win the league fairly comfortably in the end, but this is Sarri. You know, this guy, he's not a loser. He's obviously won a Europa League and a Serie A title now, so he's, you know, fulfilled really what has been expected of him as Juventus manager, and anything above this now is a bonus. But, you know, it was a surprise that Lyon won that first game, and you know, there was extenuating circumstances that maybe there was a bit of COVID-19 in the Juventus squad, and that was really contributing to the results. But you know, you'd hold out hope for Lyon in this to actually get an upset. I hope anyway, just for the sake of football. Napoli-Barcelona is more of an interesting affair because it's Gattuso, and you just love to see what Gattuso can do in these weird one-off events. I'd hope to see them do something against Barcelona, but as I said earlier in the kind of introduction to this segment, that I think Messi is the player in the rest of this Champions League tournament. They had a very disappointing end to the season. He did not. He played fantastically, even if he was angry at everybody else around him. So there's still a chance, I think, for Messi and Barcelona to really rock this tournament up as a farewell parting shot for this current manager and a few of the players that are kind of holding up spots in that Barcelona team. And you know, no offense to Gattuso, but this isn't, you know, he's not Carlo Ancelotti. I don't see him pulling out some kind of amazing tactical masterclass in this match. It'll be his brawn against kind of the brain and of Leo Messi.
And so what do you think will be the final at the end of it all? Who do you think will be meeting on the 23rd of August?
Oh, it's Atletico Madrid versus Real Madrid, obviously.
That was to complete the trilogy, as yeah, it will.
It was the return of the Jedi of Champions League finals.
That would probably be the most dramatic final that you could pair, except for maybe Paris Saint Germain against I think Paris Saint Germain against Man City would be the most depressing final imaginable.
It would, yeah.
But it is possible, I guess, considering Paris Saint Germain and maybe the favourable draw. Man City have been quite good. But I wouldn't rule out Bayern Munich either. Have been exceptional this season. They've really stepped up after a pretty disappointing last couple of years under Niko Kovac and Carlo Ancelotti. They've been fantastic in the Bundesliga. They kind of ran away with it then in the end. Their class shone through against, you know, some decent opposition in Bayern Munich, in Borussia Dortmund and Borussia Mönchengladbach and Leipzig as well themselves. So you know, I wouldn't discount them either, even if Zidane apparently has the golden touch of the Champions League, as it were.
Yeah, like, and it is very much a two-tiered competition this season, as you said. Like there is one side of the draw which is loaded with heavyweights, and there's one side of the draw which is a huge opportunity for whoever's in there. Like, in all seriousness, PSG probably are the strongest side left in that bottom half of the draw. And they could, and really on paper, should be getting to that final, Mbappe returning for it and everything like that. And then on the other side of it, you know, you can't really look beyond Bayern Munich being the powerhouse they've been this season since they got rid of Kovac. And since they won the Bundesliga, and the players they've added, even if they, you know, not all of them can play. some of them will, and some of them will provide better fodder in training at the very least to kind of keep them on edge. But yeah, in seriousness, like, I think the best teams in form that are currently in the Champions League are Bayern Munich and Man City. They will play off with each other if they do progress, and it'll be before a final. So I'd say one of those against probably PSG would be the most logical final, but I don't know. The Champions League doesn't really equate to logic these days. So yeah, let's go for Atletico Madrid versus Real Madrid.
Normally, to wrap up the show, we would look ahead to the upcoming football matches of that given week. But since we've already kind of done that with the Champions League, let's use this time to look at the rumours and speculation of the transfer window. The first news, I suppose, or if you want to call it news on the agenda, is it looks like Jadon Sancho to Manchester United will be completed this week, with Alexis Sanchez going to Inter Milan as well in return. That would be a turn up for the books for Man United, I suppose.
Well, turn up for the books is a very clever and useful pun that you've used there, whatever metaphor, because it is does seem a bit like an accounting exercise to balance everything out. I don't imagine there'll be a huge amount of money transferring between Inter and Man United for Alexis Sanchez. Maybe they'll like write off a bit of the Lukaku outstanding payments or something like that for it. But yeah, I think it's a good bit of business getting him away from your books. To say, you know, they're having to do a similar type of deal that Arsenal did with Mkhitaryan to get him out of it, and it'll be the end of that torrid transfer saga, really, to get rid of Sanchez out of the Premier League. He's had a bad few years. He hasn't done that well in Inter. He's done better than he did at United, arguably, but still nowhere near as good as he was at his previous clubs. And yeah, seeing the back him will probably be the best thing in a year, at least, for Manchester United. The flip side of it, Jadon Sancho is exciting. He's been linked for quite a long time. I was always a bit taken aback that he would go to United, bearing in mind that he was at City beforehand, that I always thought he might hold out for a different club. You know, Liverpool were interested for a while before all of this kind of restrictions that are coming into place along with COVID-19 kind of curtailed any plans they could have for spending in the near future anyway. So yeah, him to United I think is probably a good move for both parties. Like, Borussia Dortmund are fine with letting him go at this point. It's part of their model to build these players up and cut them free when they reach the kind of maximum market value. They're going to be doing the same with Erling Haaland in probably a season or two. They've just signed your man Bellingham, isn't it, from Birmingham City. They're going to do that with him in a few years again. Pulisic is a good example of one that's worked out for them as well in the past. So, there's a lot of positives out of that move. As far as where Sancho fits into Manchester United, you might know more about this, but like, what is the plan? Like, it does feel a bit like they're signing a player where they don't need that player. Like, he's an upgrade in Jesse Lingard at the moment, and I know there's been some other circumstances surrounding Jesse Lingard this season, so that could be affecting his game ability. But yeah, what is the plan? Because it seems that they have Martial, who was a centre forward. They have Rashford, who's effectively a centre forward, come winger as well, and Sancho to throw into the mix, along with Mason Greenwood. Do you stifle one of those players to fit Sancho into this team now? What about your man, James?
I think Daniel James is the one that probably misses out the most on this. But ultimately, I think given the fact that, this is very evident throughout the last few games there for Manchester United at lockdown, like, they do lack squad depth to the point where I think, like, to be relying on Mason Greenwood, an 18-year-old, to be playing 50, 60 games next season would be asking quite a lot of him, even if I do think he's a great talent. So to be able to have Sancho to come in, basically replace Greenwood, and then, I suppose, allow Greenwood to become an understudy to Anthony Martial. Greenwood is expected to become a centre forward as he gets older. Even though I've actually thought he's done quite well out wide in kind of a Mo Salah kind of way of being able to come in on the edge of the box on the right and cut in on his left, or stay on his right because he can use either foot quite well. But I think Jadon Sancho primarily will slot in on the right there of a front three. They'll sit in front of Bruno Fernandes. Like, that is a very exciting front four, but it does also feel a bit like Chelsea's transfer business, in the sense that, they do have a very good attack, Man United, at the moment, and they're just adding even more power to that. Like, how many points more will Jadon Sancho actually earn Manchester United than if they just played Mason Greenwood the whole time, relative to if they signed someone to replace Nemanja Matic, who is getting on, who is, I suppose, not even consistent enough to be playing that many games himself every week. So I'm very interested to see what Man United do after this, because, you know, with Chelsea, they've already brought in two attackers and they're looking to bring in a third in Kai Havertz. And there's not really been any reports on if they're looking at any centre-backs, left-backs or goalkeepers even. So with that, it is concerning. With Man United, there's been a few rumours here and there of them looking at a centre-back. Gabriel from Lille, I think, is one they've been linked with a lot. So it'll be interesting to see what they do from there, because it would surprise me if Man United only brought in one player, just because that hasn't been their business strategy over the last few seasons. They normally go two or three, maybe even four. And I suppose Man United as well are also looking to sell players like the likes of Jesse Lingard, Andreas Pereira, Chris Smalling. So, you know, budgets normally aren't something Man United talk about very much, because they always brag about having all the money in the world to spend. But I think, given the circumstances this summer, they are on a bit more of a tighter budget than usual. So being able to sell players like Smalling, Pereira, Lingard, it will be able to help them sell or bring in new players as well. And even just Sanchez, like, it does look like they're going to waive a transfer fee to Inter Milan, such as their desperation to get rid of him. But I saw the report there from, I think it was Gianluca DiMarzio, that by waiving a fee, they will still save 60 million in wages over the course of the next two seasons, which is frankly ridiculous.
Wow.
Like, it just goes to show like how much money they're paying Alexis Sanchez. So that in itself feels like a success.
Half a million a week. Like, that's so much money.
Yeah, it really is. Like, and they deserve the criticism for bringing him in. Like, it has been a disaster of a transfer, but this is a success that they've been able to get rid of him. And I suppose Inter Milan will be pretty happy to take him. He's done quite well for them this season when he's been fit. So a bit of a win-win for everyone involved there.
Yeah, I wouldn't agree with him being that good for them. But yeah, he's been better than he was at United, but that's not saying a lot. Yeah, there's a lot of weird things going on at United, but I think they're getting their house in order slowly but surely. I still stand over that Solskjaer isn't the manager to take them on to the next level. And I think a lot of this will be just moving around the deck chairs in the Titanic. Sure, they're getting in better quality deck chairs, maybe in the likes of Jadon Sancho instead of Alexis Sanchez at this point in his career. But yeah, I know what you mean about squad depth, but yeah, they're not getting the depth in the areas they really need at all. And yeah, we'll see what other business they do. But yeah, they can't be. Who was it? Harry Maguire played every single minute of every match so far, and they still have more matches to go in the Europa League, which we haven't really talked about. I don't know if they can sustain that into another season.
And then their Manchester rivals, Man City, have actually brought in two new players. I suppose those deals haven't been officially confirmed yet, but they will get over the line this week as well, with Ferran Torres from Valencia for, I think, 23 million. Which is a pretty good deal, but then also spending 40 million, rising to 41 million for Nathan Ake.
That extra
which
1
is
million.
A weird.
Yeah. Maybe it's to do with the way that it's being paid. Like, maybe it's like 40 million over 5 years or something, and if certain things get hit, maybe it's 40 million, 41 million over 3 years, you know, that kind of deal, so they get their money quicker. Or maybe it's to do with how Bournemouth do next season, and if they get promoted again, maybe they don't need the money immediately. Who knows? I think Ake is a good signing for City. It's you know, I think he's an okay player. He's a big guy. He's strong. He isn't the fastest in the world, but he is, I think, a very clever footballer, a good footballing brain on him. So, you know, and he proved that at Chelsea in the brief time he was there, and at Bournemouth then with his Premier League experience. So yeah, I think that was a good signing and someone they needed, especially since Pep seems to have lost faith with John Stones, and it helps with their English player quota and all that sort of stuff, and it probably paves the way for an exit for at least one of the not wanted defenders at City. And I still think they probably need another more defensive reinforcements there to kind of keep them on track with making a good attempt at the Premier League next season. Torres, is it Ferran Torres is his name, is it?
Yes. Yeah,
so he's a very exciting player. They've talked, like, done very well at the Spain under-21s. He has experience in the Liga now. It kind of comes in a position where Leroy Sané plays. You know, it gives a bit of relief, some of the pressure on Raheem Sterling, or allows him to kind of switch wings occasionally as well. So, yeah, I think it's a like-for-like replacement, really, for Sané, and probably someone they would have liked to bring in last season. had, you know, Sané not got injured in the first game of the last season.
Yeah, like, I think that's a big coup for City, especially at such a cut-rate price, such as Valencia's current financial predicament. But to be able, like, I think it was Sam Lee, the Athletic's Man City correspondent, was saying that the Torres and Ake fee adds up to the Sané fee, and that's probably why it was such a weird announcement for Ake that it was 40 rising to 41.
Balance in the like, books. There's a lot of that this summer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There really is, especially considering FFP has been kind of set aside for a year due to the whole pandemic itself. So very strange times in terms of financials. But yeah, to be able to offload Sané, who essentially didn't play last season, I don't think he kicked a ball once for City.
He had some sub appearances right at the end, right before lockdown. He was back.
Right. Okay.
Or am I imagining that?
I can't remember, to be honest. So to be able to replace someone that basically wasn't there last season, yeah, anyway, like they still scored 102 goals last season. They weren't struggling for goals.
Season's
so
not over yet.
Bring in Torres. True. But like they've been able to bring in Torres and lose Sané, and it feels like they just basically, it's like, you know, they didn't lose anything, but they still gained someone. So to be able to do that and also bring in cover for Laporte, which I think was their, you know, biggest problem last season, is that he got injured immediately and then they didn't have cover for him.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty big piece of business for them, I think. Yeah.
I still think they need a few more players. Like maybe Rodri will take over the mantle from Fernandinho at the end of at the beginning of next season, and that will be their new holding midfield, you know, basically dynamo. But yeah, I still think they need something to kind of, you know, protect their weak underbelly, because that's something that City definitely do have.
And then finally, the last rumour that's been going on in Italy has been quite interesting, that Antonio Conte has fallen out with the board, and that the Inter Milan management are looking at Max Allegri to replace him for the start of next season.
Yeah, it'll be a coup for them if they get Max Allegri, in fairness to them. They put a bit of investment into the side. You know, we were talking about Sanchez already, Lukaku's there. And obviously Conte got the team back into a winning mentality, I think, and definitely moved them up the table. Although it did kind of fall apart at times there during the season, it's kind of normalised at this point. And yeah, it's perfect for Allegri to come in and really challenge. And if Sarri stays at Juventus, I would imagine Allegri might have the upper hand on him.
Yeah, like Sarri's predicament, management, his tenure at Juve does look a little sketchy at the moment. Based, I suppose a lot will come down to how they do against Lyon and later in the Champions League. Like if they get knocked out by Lyon, it wouldn't entirely shock me if he was sacked.
Yeah.
And which also brings me on to the fact that Antonio Conte has apparently been putting out feelers with his mates at Juve to see if he could come back, which would be quite sensational.
Yeah. Be like the good old days, getting the band back together. But yeah, like I think that would be a good move for all involved, really. If Inter can get someone like Allegri and Juventus can find a ready-made replacement in Conte, I think it probably will bode for a good Serie A next season.
Yeah, so it's all kind of heating up at the moment as the transfer window really kicks into action, and as the clubs decide which managers should stay and which managers should go. It's
Sarri to Napoli, like
interesting. Yeah. It's a very interesting few weeks ahead, so hopefully we can divulge and kind of mess around and see what we think of all these things as they progress.
Yeah, absolutely. I look forward to seeing this World Cup Champions League thing experiment happen, and hopefully we can get some good football out of it as well.
Yeah, and I suppose what's left of us now is to sign off, so thank you for being here, Andrew.
Thank you for having me, Declan.
And we'll be back again next week. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, then don't forget you can tell family and friends about the show. Spread the word of the Total Football Takeover. You can also follow us on social media at the TF Pod on Twitter and Total Football Pod on Instagram. We can also be found on podcast services including Spotify by searching Total Football Podcast. The more the merrier. That's what we always say.